شمس. And the story here, remember, is that if we have an L times L matrix, we could use full diagonalization. And that means the function eigen, was it eigen?
Yeah.
And we would obtain, we could diagonalize this matrix on, with time that scales as L to the third power. But last week, we saw that if we use instead, if we only care about N EV eigenvectors, we could use the function AX. And the time were reduced to L squared times NEV. OK? So if you just care about, say, the ground state and a couple of excited states of your Hamiltonian, you can use an algorithm that scales as L squared instead of L to the third power. So today, we want to use sparse or exploit sparse diagonalization. This we will actually we will do this more detailed Friday, but what we're going to use is this power method. And the time will scale only as order L, OK? That's, remember that for us, L is 2 to the n, where n is a number of spins in our spin chain. And so this is 2 to the 3n, 2 to the 2n. This is going to be 2 to the n. And then we'll see that there is a factor n in front. And as an exponential in n, this is much more favorable. But still, it's exponentially. The cost, the time, the computational time still grows exponentially in the number of spins. So the idea, the main idea is that we will not need to build this L times L matrix. This L times L matrix for us was this 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix, which was the Hamiltonian. And we will today we will exploit the structure of this Hamiltonian, namely that it's a sum of local terms, to implement matrix, so vector matrix multiplication, without ever building explicitly this matrix. And so this 2 to the n is basically the cost of storing or of manipulating the vector. The vector has 2 to the n components. Okay? And we will never build the Hamiltonian as a 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix. We are not going to build it. And so the cost will be dominated by manipulations of these 2 to the n elements of the vector. Very good. So let me tell you about this power method. What I'm going to say first does not yet exploit any structure of the Hamiltonian. It's just a general observation that you may be familiar with. So power method. What we want to have in mind here is that we have some Hamiltonian, which in diagonal basis will look like e to the n, n, n. So n are the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. I'm going to assume, well, there are L different eigenvalues. Where I'm going to assume that we've managed to write all these energies, these eigenvalues, this is zero, that the ground state energy is some negative number down here. The first excited state energy is some number down here, all the way to the largest energy, which is still negative. Okay, so I'm going to assume that the full spectrum of the Hamiltonian is negative. Okay? That you can always do by shifting, right? By subtracting the identity operator from the Hamiltonian. So that's something we will have to do, but it's very easy to accomplish. And then there is this observation. Let's try to, under this context, with this convention for the energies, which I will express by saying that the ground state energy is smaller than first excited state energy, and so on. But in absolute value, it is the opposite. It's the absolute value of the energy, ground state energy, is larger than any of the absolute values of the excitation. Then with this, what we have is, let's consider a generic state, generic vector, and let's write it in this basis. So we can expand it in this basis, and the complex coefficients in front will be, we just call them phi n. Okay? So now let's ask the question. So that's just a generic state. Let's have a look at what happens when we take this state and we multiply it by the Hamiltonian. Okay? So when we do that, well, this is the state, this is the Hamiltonian, so you multiply these two expressions together, and what you get is a new state with coefficients En phi n. Right? That's what you get. So let's do this. Let's multiply p times, right? Let's hit this wave function with the Hamiltonian once, and then again, then again. So what's going to happen here is that the result is e to the n, e to the p, phi n, n. Is that clear? Yes? Just think of this, you know, in this basis, this Hamiltonian just looks like it's a diagonal matrix, and we're just multiplying. Right? So, okay, very good. So now the interesting observation. Let's write the result, okay, as a first term, which is e to the zero, the ground state energy to the power p. Okay? And then we'll have the first term is phi zero ground state plus phi one first excited state, etc. And here we just need to compensate for this factor. So we get something like that. Okay? Can you see? No. What do I have to do? What do you mean? is it reflection problem?
No, I need the glasses.
Oh, you want to sit?
Yeah.
All right. So what we have then is that E1 divided by E0, remember our convention, this ratio, right, is smaller than 1. So E1 over E0 is smaller than 1. Now what happens when you take the power p of a number smaller than 1? Just the case, right? So the idea is that this amplitude here is exponentially suppressed with the power of h, right? We apply h to the power p, and we're suppressing this component exponentially with some constant here where this constant is something like the log of E0 or E1 or something. Okay? The idea is that we are suppressing, this is the ground state amplitude. And the first excited state amplitude on the resulting wave function is being suppressed exponentially. And the same is true for the rest of terms here. So the conclusion is that if we take HP pi, which just means multiply the state p times by the Hamiltonian, and we normalize this, meaning we get rid of this guy in here, okay? But basically, this goes as, this is the ground state plus order e to the minus p. Okay? So this is a way to get the ground state. Let's first make sure that the Hamiltonian has all the energies on the negative side, and then start multiplying this some initial state by the Hamiltonian many, many times. This will bring, the result of this will be a vector that is exponentially close to the ground state. Okay? Good, so our goal will be to actually do this, to hit some initial state of the L qubits or L spins with the Hamiltonian, multiply it many, many times. Okay? I have to move this up and it will disappear. Actually, it will stay. So our goal now is to understand how to do this matrix vector multiplication without ever building the matrix. Okay? So, two sparse multiplication. So our goal is to, given some wave function, to obtain a new wave function, which will be the result of multiplying by h. Now, h, and that's what we're going to exploit, is a local Hamiltonian, which means that it's a sum of local terms. Maybe the last term wraps around periodic boundary condition. So really, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get psi. We want to multiply it by h12. We want to get psi multiplied by h23 and add these two together. We want to multiply by, say, n1. Okay? So we have n different terms, and we want to multiply the state by each of these terms. Right? That's if we manage to make, to compute this new vector, then we have what we want, which is psi prime. Okay? And now here's the interesting bit. This Hamiltonian term, remember that H12 meant it was keyword for putting identities everywhere else. Right? But identities are known to do nothing. So let me try to represent first psi. Remember that we can expand it in some local basis. This is a local basis, it's a product basis. On each of the spins, this could be 0 or 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. So we have 2 to the n complex coefficient right here. Okay. Now, let me graphically represent this answer in this way. For each index, I put a leg. I draw some kind of rectangle, okay? Maybe I paint it, and then each leg corresponds to an index. Okay? So for instance, if I just had a matrix, I would represent this in this way. Okay? But now we have more than two indices because we have a state vector on n spins. So I'm just going to use this graphical notation to represent this tensor. Is that okay? Is it okay? When I say tensor, I just mean an array of complex numbers with n indices. I don't mean general relativity tensor.
What's the indices then? So here I can't read them.
I1, I2, IN, where this each one of them takes value 0 or 1 or spin up down. So the, you know, example, right? If we just had three spins, we would say psi is equal to sum over alpha, beta, gamma of psi alpha, beta, gamma, alpha, beta, gamma, or more explicitly, if this is zeros and ones, we have psi 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 plus psi 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, etc. Okay, that's what I mean. So you see that we end up organizing, in this case, eight complex numbers. We organize them as a tensor of with three indices, where each index takes two values. Okay. So I'm going to make heavy use of this graphical notation. So I hope it's clear. Okay. If you see a tensor and it has n indices, just draw some figure and put legs, n legs. Very good. So using this notation, let's have a look at the Hamiltonian term. So remember, say H23. Okay. So this means identity on 1, identity on 4, etc. So we could represent this object in this way. Okay. So this would be first spin, second spin, third spin, fourth spin, nth spin. We act with the identity operator. That's a straight line. Nothing is happening. We don't have to transform that spin. And the only non-trivial transformation is going in here through some object that we could write as a matrix. And we would find, for instance, this could be sigma 2, sigma x2, tensor sigma 3 x as well. So in this case, there would be a tensor product structure. So we would draw it like that. Meaning that we do something to the second spin, but do nothing second and the third spin, but not on the rest. So the idea is that we can just signal where the non-trivial transformation goes by just having identities everywhere else. And generically here, it was a more, you know, a more robust operator acting on 2 and 3. We'd have indices ij, I prime, j prime. And we would just represent this more general operator in this way, where this is I, this is j. So if you want, in the notation I just had, let me call it alpha, beta, alpha prime, beta prime. So these are the indices alpha, beta, alpha prime, beta prime. Okay. So you have here an object with four indices, and I represent it as a blur with four legs. Okay. I didn't represent it like this, as in the case of a vector, because I need these legs to go to different places. That's all. Okay. So I want now to explain why multiplying this times this has a cost which is not exponentially 2n, but just exponentially in n, n being the number of a spin. Let's do that. It's going to be very easy. So option one, which is wrong, and we don't want to follow, is that we take h, say 2, 3. Let me start with h1, 2. It's going to be even easier. Okay? And we can include all the identities that we were missing. Okay? And build that into a huge term 1, 2, that is a 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix. This big matrix would look like this. Now we don't exploit, so 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, n, 1, 2, n. So this would be h1, 2, where we don't exploit that secretly that there is an identity operator inside. Okay. Now, if we build this, we've lost the game. We already lost the game because we just built an object that is 2 to the n. Okay, memory is 2 to the n, sorry, 2 to the 2n. Okay? So we don't want to do that. But if we did that, then we could multiply this times the wave function. Okay? And we just have to contract these indices. And that's the same as saying we're multiplying the vector times the matrix. Instead of doing that, we're going to do something simpler. So option two, we just, again, write a wave function with indices 1, 2, 2n. And we realize that this guy is only acting non-trivially on the first two spins and doing nothing on the rest. Okay? So our goal is to contract this times that. Okay? But now what we're going to realize is that if we take our wave function, or I say wave function, I mean vector, wave function, same thing. If we organize the first two indices, we join them together, and we join the rest of indices together, this is nothing. This looks like a matrix, right? It has two indices now. If we do the same for this guy, for the Hamiltonian term, we join these two indices. These two indices, this looks like another matrix. And so now we could multiply this matrix times that matrix. I'll do it here. Okay, so that's the Hamiltonian term. This is the wave function. This is a matrix-matrix multiplication. Okay? Now you would think, well, that's L to the third power, right? The cost of multiplying L times L matrix is L to the third power. But the point is that this is the cost for an L times L matrix. These are not L times L matrices. Okay? We need to revisit how much the cost would be in this case. And when you do that, you realize this index here, as I mentioned, 2 to the n minus 2, because it contains n minus 2 spins. This index here has dimension 4 because it contains 2 spins, so 2 to the 2, 4, and the same this one. So, oh, I just realized I have colors here. Too late. All right, so I delete the thing that we don't want to do, and I say that again. What we have is a matrix multiplication, where this is the state and this is the Hamiltonian term. This index here takes 4 values. This index here takes 4 values. And this index here takes 2 to the n minus 2 values. Okay? And if you count the cost of doing that by, you know, there is a sum over an intermediate index here, so you have sum over alpha. Let's call this I and this j, sum over alpha of h I j psi, so I alpha, alpha j. Okay? So we have this. This runs from 1 to 4. And the indices, this has to be done for all I, which runs from 1 to 4, and for all j, j, which runs from 1 to 2 to the n minus 2. Now you can ask the question, well, how many operations you have to do? Okay? And the answer is the size of this index times the size of this index times the size of this index. Okay? If this, if each index was size L, that would give you L to the 3, as you've seen before. But in this case, this means the time scales as 4 times 4 times 2 to the n minus 2, which is the same as 2 to the n plus 2. Okay? So this is the time. This is the time that it takes to multiply your wave function by a Hamiltonian term acting only on two spins. Okay? Question?
That's only assuming that the Hamiltonian only comes with two.
That's right. So what we want to do today is exploit the fact that your Hamiltonian is local. And what we mean by local here is nearest neighbor. It doesn't have to be nearest neighbor, but it, I mean, it could be two body, say the first spin with the third one, and so on. But yeah, we will consider only nearest neighbor. Okay. So this is how you end up multiplying one Hamiltonian term times the wave function. And now, how many times do we have to do this to complete our task? Remember, our task is to multiply the full Hamiltonian times the wave function. So how many times do we have to do that? N, because we have n Hamiltonian terms, right? So this will be the cost of multiplying the wave function times the first term in the Hamiltonian, and we do this for each Hamiltonian term. And so the total time will be n times. N times this. So here you have it. That's only 2 to the n, not 2 to the 2n. Okay? Are there questions? If there are no questions, we just need to do this.
What do you mean with the change notation of h indices? Like we before, the indices of small h were which spins were connected, and now we have indices like 1, 1, and 4, 4. So,
yeah. So what we are counting here is how many complex coefficients it takes to specify the Hamiltonian term. Or I drew the Hamiltonian term like this, where each index took two values. In up or down, zero. But you can always reorganize your indices, and that's something we'll have to learn today. You can reshape. Did we do reshape? Oh, we did reshape. So we'll learn something else. So we can, right, we did reshape. So for instance, this tensor, let's call it A, right? It has at this point could have four indices. So we could take reshape of this object with four indices and specify that we just want two indices, each one taking having four different values. Right? So it's still this object is a list of 16 complex numbers. And what we are doing here by joining these indices, just restructuring how we organize these 16 complex numbers. And that's something that is useful to just turn some crazy contraction into a matrix multiplication. So more generally, I could say, here's my tensor. Here I have a tensor with many legs. Here I have another tensor with many, many legs. And this one is contracted with this one, and this one is contracted with this one. Well, is that a matrix multiplication? Maybe it doesn't look like that. Okay. But if I take these two indices, and I join them before doing this operation. So the blue index now is the result of combining those two indices. If I take all these open indices and I also combine them with a reshape, and I take all these other indices and I also combine them with a reshape, now this is a matrix-matrix multiplication. Okay? So what we're going to do today is to just take our wave function, our local Hamiltonian term, reshape them so that they are two matrices, multiply them. And then you can always undo the reshape after the multiplication. So you multiply them, you get some new object here, which is the result, is the matrix that is the result of multiplying these two. And you can always reshape these guys back. Okay? Afterwards. But that's what we're going to do. More questions? Okay, so let's do this. And to do that, we'll need two functions. So, as I said a moment ago, we'll need the reshape. But we will also need the permute dims. And remember, reshape is what you would use, for instance, to go from 5 legs to just 2 legs, right, by joining, say, indices. Now, permute dims is what you will do, you can use to actually permute the order. So, imagine that you have 3 indices and you're not happy with which one is the first one. You want to turn the third one to the first one. Then you can use this function, permute dims, to do that. In this case, for instance, for this case, if this is tensor T, I would use permute dims of tensor T. And then I need to specify where I want to put the first index, so the first index here would go into the second position, the second into the third position, and the last one would come first. Okay. So that's how I would indicate that I want my array of complex numbers, my tensor, that I want to reshuffle or reorganize, permute its indices. Okay, so these are the two key functions that we'll be using. And let's do it. So you all have the notebook. So we start with the Ising model. We can build the two-point Hamiltonian, the two-side Hamiltonian. So today, instead of building the whole Hamiltonian, we just need the two-side Hamiltonian, right? This H12 that I was talking about. So that's what this build Ising function will do for you. You can still specify the balance between the angle. Say this would be critical Ising model. So this will build a two-side Hamiltonian. Maybe a comment is due here. So remember that the Ising Hamiltonian that we've been discussing is of the form cosine of theta sigma x plus sine of theta sigma z. Sum over sides. So the weight in front of the two different terms is cosine and sine. Here, the weight in front of the xx term is cosine, but the weight in front of sine theta, sorry, in front of the magnetic field is not sine, but sine divided by 2. This is because we want to split the Hamiltonian into two body terms, but the single body term, this one, belongs to two possible places, right? So remember, this is the first term, h12. If I put, right, so hz is the sigma z on both sides. So to make it symmetric, we consider the case where we just add the sigma z on both sides. Okay, this is a two-body term, so there are two sides in which you put the sigma z. So we'll put it in both on both sides, but because there will be another two-body term later on, we don't want to repeat the sigma z too much, so we need to divide by two. Okay. So I just did this thing where I, instead of having just one side, I put the two sides, contributions to the two sides. But because I'm going to sum over all the sides, I would be repeating contributions, I have to divide by 2. Yep.
Why not just die and leave out
that? Yeah, I could have done that. I could have done that, but then the explanation would be too simple. So anyway, it's a good idea in general to have balance operators that are not biased towards one side. It's a matter of symmetries. It's a reasonable thing to do most of the time. And so I just did it by without thinking, and then I have to explain how it works. Yes, there would be nothing wrong if you just had the magnetic field on one side. Very good. So you can all try to see whether this piece of code works. Hopefully it will. Yeah. And now we have these two body terms. That's the 16 complex coefficients we were talking about. They just happen to be real. Most of them are zero. So this is our two-body term. And the first thing, remember, the first thing we wanted was to normalize the energies such that all the energies of the full Hamiltonian are negative. Okay? And a way to accomplish that is by having a look at the eigenvalues of this two-body term. And the eigenvalues happen to be minus 1, minus 0.7, plus 0.7, and 1. Okay. And now we're just going to shift this. We're going to change this two-body term by a constant. So that's going to happen here. We're going to shift by an amount. So this is, again, the identity operator. Oh, in the meantime, we learned that this can be simplified to just saying I, right? See if it works. Yeah. So what we do is, from above, we take the largest eigenvalue, that's shift of the energies, and we just subtract. We take the two body Hamiltonian, and we subtract this eigenvalue times the identity. Okay? So what that means is we're just shifting the full spectrum, right? It was going from minus 1 to 1, and now it's going from minus 2 to 0. That's 0. Okay? So we just shifted this spectrum so that all the eigenvalues are negative. And now you are guaranteed that if you add such two body terms together, the resulting total Hamiltonian will also have all the spectrum negative. So all the energies are going to be negative.
The last energy is 0.
It's 0. Okay, none of them is positive. What we want to accomplish is that, you know, this effect that when we multiply a wave function with the Hamiltonian, that we amplify the ground state. And this, to accomplish this, we want that the ground state energy, the absolute value of the ground state energy, is the largest energy. of the largest number. Right? So if we shift everybody to not being positive, the ground state energy is going to be the, which is the most negative, will also be the one with largest absolute value. Yes? Okay, so that was just a shift. Good. And then we're ready. So this function here, what this function does is it takes as an input your vector of 2 to the n coefficients and the two-body term, Newtonian term. Okay, that's the input. And then what it does is it just organizes this vector and these two-body terms such that you can multiply them as a matrix multiplication. So here you see psi is being reshaped into, or psi is being reshaped into a 4 times 2 to the n minus 2 matrix. Okay, that's what we discussed before somewhere. It is to say that we take our psi with indices 1, 2, n, and we just put these guys together and the rest of indices together. Okay, that's what we're doing. Now it's a matrix. Then this psi, this is another vector that we use to initially it's just empty. And we'll just add contributions from, we have to make a sum of n terms. So h psi contains the partial sum of these n terms. Very good. So, and now what we do is we include h2 times psi. So we're going to multiply the Hamiltonian term times psi. So the Hamiltonian term is already organized as a matrix from the beginning. And so we just do this multiplication. This multiplication is this multiplication, OK? And then what we need to do is to reshape the objects such that eventually we can repeat the same transformation after. So what we want to do now is we want to move the indices. We want to do the following. We are done applying the two-body term on the first two indices. So now we would like to apply a two-body term on the second two indices. But it turns out that it's nicer if you just move the indices. Okay? And now apply the two-body term on the first two indices, which is effectively the second and the third. Okay? This allows you, this allows this loop to be much simpler, right? Okay? So just shift the indices. And that's being done here by basically I want to shift all these guys and move this one here. So I can just join all these indices together. I join them together. And then permute them with this guy and then expand them again. Okay? This happens to be easier. So that's what's happening here. We join the indices of psi as the first and the rest. And then we permute first and the rest. And then we reshape the state. And then it's ready for the iteration. Okay? And we do the same, not just for psi, but this partial sum h psi. Very good. So I thought I would give you this done as usual, but it will. If you'll have to play with it to see if it works and how to generalize it. All right, so, and then the rest of the code, and I see that I'm not doing great with time. There is a colloquium, so I have to stop in 10 minutes. No problem, Friday is waiting for us. But the idea is that now here we're just starting with n strings, so that's much larger than you could do with exact diagonalization already, with full matrix diagonalization. We start with a random wave function, and which we normalize. And then we multiply this wave function by the Hamiltonian. So let's try this. And let's see what's the cost of such multiplication. And it takes less than a second. Okay, we've multiplied this huge vector times the full Hamiltonian in less than a second. We never build a Hamiltonian explicitly. That's why we can do this. Okay. And then an application of that is that you can iterate. So let's apply this Hamiltonian to the wave function how many times? 20 times. Okay. And when we're done, so we just did that 20 times. And when we're done, don't look at this yet. Here, what we have is we compute the energy, the the expectation value of the Hamiltonian by this wave function as a function of iteration. So our wave function is being hit by the Hamiltonian. We renormalize it. The wave function is changing, okay? And we look at how much energy this wave function has. This is the result as a function of iterations. After multiply, at the beginning it has energy zero, whatever that means. Then it has energy minus two. I don't know what does. Yeah, I don't know how it can have energy zero, but anyway. Maybe that's by comparison with the initial energy. The idea is that the energy is going down, see? As you multiply more and more the initial state by the Hamiltonian, you obtain a new wave function that has lower and lower energy. And that's going to converge to the ground state. Okay? The ground state being the state with the lowest possible energy. And then this is written in a way that if you want to do it again, so you're not happy with the result, you can go up here. Where is it? So we can say, OK, 20 steps more. Then we'll plot it. And I'm waiting for the next 20 steps. There we are, and then we can plot the result. And this is, here you have 40 steps. So this is the evolution of the energy from the very beginning. Okay, and these were just the last 20 steps. You can follow the whole evolution from the beginning, and here just seeing the last 20 steps. So let's do it just once more, and then we declare that that's our approximation to the ground state, because we don't have more time. So that's we're multiplying by the Hamiltonian 20 more times. And so let's have a look at this. Now what we see is that indeed, from the very beginning, a total of 60 times, okay, the energy is already converging. Roughly speaking, this number is becoming very stable. But if you want to look at the last 20 steps, you have it here. And you see that the energy is still changing. Of course, because the scale is not the same as that. And you see that in 20 iterations, it went from the energy being minus 16.4 to being minus 16.9. Okay? So we're already changing the third digit. Okay? So you run this for a couple of minutes more, and then you get that the ground state energy, the energy that your state has, is basically only changing on the third or fourth digit. And at some point you say, OK, I'm happy with that approximation to the ground state. OK? And so I didn't measure time properly, surprise. But these are the exercises for you. The first one is, again, with 20 spins. Find the lowest energy state with a given momentum. Okay. Eric, are you desperate? Oh, you're thinking, good. And let me read the second exercise. For n equal to 20 spins again, compute the first excited state with momentum. Okay, no, momentum, there is a movie. With momentum k equal to zero. So that would be above the ground state with zero momentum. The ground state has zero momentum. And the first excited state with zero momentum will be orthogonal to the ground state. Okay. And the idea is that with a bit of thinking like Eric, plus the tools that you already have, you should be able to find excited the lowest energy state in each momentum sector. At the moment, the code only finds it for k equal or zero momentum, which is a ground state. And also how to find excitations on top of the ground state. Okay? And yeah, you can do that in the next 4 minutes. I think this would take half an hour at least. Actually, let's use this 4 minutes so that somebody tells me how to do this. Forget about how to code it. What would be the idea? How can you find the lowest energy state with a given moment? And the answer is, this is your wave function. And if it had zero momentum, let's start with zero momentum. If it had zero momentum, if I permute its legs like this, according to a translation, this would be a translation by one lattice size. So if the momentum is zero, I expect to obtain exactly the same state. So what I'm using here, remember, is that the Hamiltonian commutes with the translation operator. And that meant that when we have an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, it will be also an eigenstate, can be chosen to be also an eigenstate of the translation operator. So remember that we managed to diagonalize the Hamiltonian and the translation operator at the same time. So the idea of this exercise is that you can now try to enforce the condition while trying to diagonalize Hamiltonian, or trying to find the lowest energy state by fitting the wave function, by multiplying it with the Hamiltonian. You can, at the same time, impose conditions on the wave function. Okay? So a condition that you can enforce is if this is true, and this is the translation, right here you have the translation operator, that's T. That means that you obtain the same wave function times phase that depends on its momentum. Okay. So what you could do is you can try to go towards the lower energy states by multiplying by the Hamiltonian, but then making sure that this relation is true. So in this way, you would be going down in energy, but with a well-defined momentum. OK, I get it. I see faces that I'll tell you how to do it. Okay.
Yes.
Maybe you can try the second exercise though. You know, if you want to go beyond the ground state, just make sure that you keep removing the ground. You have a wave function, you can make it orthogonal to the ground state, then time evolve. Then make sure it's still orthogonal to the ground state, then time evolve. You hit with the Hamiltonian, you make it orthogonal to the ground state, you hit the Hamiltonian, you make it orthogonal, okay? And that's gonna give you the lowest energy state that is not the Hamiltonian. First excited state. Very good. And let's stop here because there is a colloquium.